Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Grania Reid, Head of Marketing at ExchangeWire, and your host for today. I'm delighted to be joined by Lindsay Rowntree, COO at ExchangeWire.
Hello, lovely to be here.
And John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire. John, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm delighted to be here, Jane. Thank you.
Yeah, nice ExchangeWire team podcast.
Had to be one better than me, honestly. Bloody hell.
No? Yes, delighted. I thought I'd trump you with delighted.
Let's not start another laughing fit.
No, maybe not.
And this week we're unpacking three big news stories that point to major changes across platforms, devices and ad tech standards. Apple Maps inches towards ad monetization with a revamped iPad Pro in the pipeline. Comcast pushes programmatic into the world of linear TV. And the AdCP Agentic AI standard stirs fresh debate across the industry. First up, Apple Maps users could start seeing ads in the app as soon as next year, according to a report from Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. The move will allow restaurants and other businesses to pay to have their details featured more prominently within the app searches. Apple intends to leverage AI to ensure that results are relevant and useful for users. Lindsay, to you, how do you expect users will respond to these ads appearing on Apple Maps?
I am intrigued as to how they will respond. I mean, Google already has ads on Google Maps, but I'd say Apple Maps then. And I think that users have responded fairly well to them. I suppose that from Apple's perspective, Apple has put itself forward as the privacy conscious choice for a device. And so when you are searching for something and searching for a location, seeing ads that are tailored to you might feel like it's breaching that the privacy requirements that you have and maybe why you might have chosen Apple in the first place. So I wonder if an Apple user, which tends to be an Apple Maps user, which I don't really know the demographics of Apple Maps versus Google Maps users. I know that generally when you're from an advertiser's perspective, an Apple iPhone user versus a Google Android device tend to be more affluent and tend to kind of, you normally get sort of higher value conversions from that kind of from an advertiser's perspective. So, but also know that many iPhone users use Google Maps, not Apple Maps. So I'm not really sure kind of what the breakdown of that is. I tried to find out and we really struggled to find kind of anything meaningful because obviously Apple and Google aren't releasing that data. So you wonder if there might be kind of like an annoyance from an Apple Maps user than maybe there would have been from a Google Maps user, which might be more used to advertising and pop-ups because they maybe have an Android device versus what they would get on an Apple device. But as long as that's both native and relevant, I think, feels fairly seamless, I think that they might be okay with it from a user standpoint. I think what gets interesting is kind of the advertising aspect of it and what that then looks like from an advertiser. With Google Maps, you buy an ad through pay-per-click, through cost per click. So it's kind of the same as you might run a sort of a search campaign. And I assume that Apple will run it the same way through their search ads platform. But the majority of users are long-tail brands, so kind of your bricks and mortar, kind of independent stores, independent businesses that invest kind of a small amount of money in pay-per-click per month, and also want to get presence on Apple on Google Maps. If the same rule applies to Apple Maps, which you'd assume it would, Apple doesn't really have a relationship with those kinds of companies, whereas Google and Meta really do, and like they really have gone after the small businesses, and they make it easy for them to access, easy for them to buy. Either to you, they provide regular support if you need it. As a small business, I don't know if Apple has that relationship yet, and I'm intrigued to see kind of where that will go and what that will look like. And that's, I think, probably for me more interesting is one of what from the advertiser perspective, how they will build out long tail relationships. And also, I'm also interested in the US. I'm assuming this is probably just US focused for now anyway. I'm also interested in kind of what the penetration is of Google Maps versus Apple Maps. I know that in the US, the penetration of iPhones is higher than Android devices. But also, as I just mentioned, I'm assuming I'm a Google Maps user, yet I have an iPhone. More people use Google Maps on iPhones than they do maybe Apple Maps because it's generally rubbish. Although it has improved. I think back to my kind of pay when I was a lowly paid search exec, and the demographic, the share of voice is quite different. But back then,
if you're investing money in Google search engine versus Yahoo and Bing, Yahoo and Bing share of voice is like 10% versus Google's 90%. So you'd be like, it was like an opportunity cost of, can I actually be asked to put to spend my time uploading all my campaigns and doing and running these like complex campaigns on Yahoo and Bing when so little budget goes into them and so little conversions and clicks come through them, when I can just focus on Google, which has the vast majority of the audience. The split is a little bit different for Google Maps and Apple Maps, but still the same rule applies. If I were a small business, would I bother with Apple Maps? And I'm already running Google Maps, knowing that Apple Maps probably has a smaller audience and I don't really have a relationship with them. Maybe it's hard to use. I don't know. And that's why I think word might be interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. And like, John, I know you're an iPhone owner. Lindsay obviously alluded there that she's definitely a Google Maps user. What would you your preference be, and how do you think Apple will balance the ad revenue side with the user experience?
Yeah, it was funny when I read the story. I was surprised that it wasn't already happening. Mm. It just seems like such a natural step. Mm. Geolocation stuff is very important, and it's a really interesting way of serving ads. And Google have obviously, you know, they have a really good Maps product and they incorporate ads into that quite easily. So I was surprised that Apple hadn't done it. And I think Lindsay's point about the high value user is really interesting, and whether that affects how they will accept advertising on Apple Maps. I mean, I am an iPhone user. I use Google Maps on my iPhone. I find it just, it's built on far many more data points. So it's actually a more reliable service, but people do use Apple Maps. Yeah, I wonder who wants to get involved. And like you said about the small, medium businesses side of things, like Google has that nailed,
yeah,
and Apple don't.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that's what they want to tap into with announcing ads. I imagine they want that business to come into Apple, but I just wonder what they do offer advertisers, really.
I know. And I assume the same. I was thinking about this, but like, why are Apple doing this now? I think in the office yesterday, there was mention of Apple's advertising business will reach $12 billion in revenue by 2026, 2027. So it's significant. And this would represent a small portion of that. But also, there's this kind of potential thought, potentially, that is Apple trying to go after revenue that doesn't involve tariffs? Like, if they're struggling with what a tariff could mean for them in terms of the device production, and actually advertising represents a massive opportunity for them, could they then decide to go that way instead? I don't know. I'm just speculating. But like, it just, yeah, felt...
It's good speculation. I like it. Yeah. No, I hadn't thought of that at all. So interesting. Because you do wonder why Apple would need to do this. You
know, I know.
They have TV as a loss leader. They do these massively huge budgeted shows, the production shows, and they don't really push for subscriptions on Apple TV. They just have it because it's there and it goes with the device, and the device is the moneymaker. And so, yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That this could be a way of offsetting any financial damage done by tariffs.
I mean, I love reading way too much into things, so I might well have done just that. But I mean, yeah, sure, I'm putting it out there.
That's right, I like it. Yeah, that's no, I like the narrative.
Do you think it's also a stepping stone towards an ad network for Apple?
I mean, I suppose so. Like advertising across the Apple network, because it's fragmented, because a lot of their advertising revenue comes from App Store optimization. And obviously they've got Apple News, they've got all these different platforms. I suppose Maps represents another platform for them. Is there a way of just being able to just kind of tap into the entire Apple advertising network and kind of, I want to put this money and here's my money, Apple. You decide where you want to put it, here or here. Yeah. Could work.
Could it be a test for the rest of the Apple suite? So they put ads in Maps to see if Apple users will be all right with ads. And if they are, bang, it's in TV.
Here we go.
Bang, it's on, you know, it's across the Apple spectrum.
Yeah.
It's a little just test in the water.
But they've got ads in the App Store.
I suppose it's already been tested.
But they are their native ads, right? Like, you will see an ad on Apple TV, and that ad is a trailer for another Apple product, another Apple show. Everything you're seeing in the App Store is an ad for an app. What if they are trying to bring in third-party ads? I'm thinking like retail media, like a retail media type guys, where it's like it's a non-endemic ad in the Apple environment that could potentially play into it in some way. But I mean, an ad on Apple Maps, there's a lot of A's. I'm really struggling to say the sentences. An ad on Apple Maps is still endemic. It's still like part of the ecosystem because I am on a map and I am seeing an ad for something that I'm about to go and potentially visit, rather than something completely random. Like, oh, I'm a non-endemic ad, could be car insurance. Like, I'm about to drive somewhere. Oh, have you thought about car insurance? Like, that would be non-endemic. But it could be like a starting point for them to go down that route as well. You never know what route they could take it in.
Yeah, let's see. And I'm sure we'll all be watching how Apple balances their monetization against user experience as this evolves. Let's move on to a story about Comcast. Comcast Advertising announced that the cable provider's linear TV inventory will now be available on a targetable, biddable basis for advertisers who want to buy inventory programmatically. For the moment, the inventory is only available through FreeWheel, Comcast Video ad platform. In the future, Comcast intends to also offer its programmatic linear inventory via other buy-side platforms, as well as eventually allowing other publishers to make their linear inventory available through FreeWheel. A spokesperson from Comcast Advertising said that their ultimate goal is to help buyers reach the same audiences across all forms of TV buying through a single unified programmatic workflow. John, how does this change the TV landscape for media buyers?
It's fitting that this show is going to be going out on Halloween morning, because it's like linear TV is back from the dead again. It's come from the grave. It is. I think we are often guilty of talking about linear as if it's a thing of the past and that it doesn't exist anymore and that everything is streaming in CTV. And time and again, we talk about Saturday Night Takeaway or whatever Ant and Dex thing is as an example. Like, people still watch linear.
What do you mean, whatever Ant and Dex thing is? How dare you?
I don't want
to. Is that still a thing?
The people in this country know. Oh, they'd be fuming at me right now.
Yeah.
Whatever that thing is.
But they are watching it. They are watching on linear TV. And I think we talk about linear as if it's the past, when in fact it's still there. And this is kind of, it's really interesting that they're opening up programmatic and RTB to it, because it does kind of revivify it a little bit. And it still has a lot to offer that streaming doesn't. I think there's still a lot too linear in terms of the audience you can reach, the demographics that are there. So again, not a surprise to see it launched, but just kind of, it's like linear is here to stay for the time being. No, I think it's interesting.
What are your thoughts on this, Lindsay?
I have many.
Where do you want to start?
So I had to do some research to get my head around exactly kind of how linear TV works in the US market, because I'm not as familiar with it as I obviously am in the UK and in Europe, and also some APAC markets as well. So as I understand it, and any Americans feel free to write in and tell me that I'm completely wrong, but this is how I understood it for any non-Americans that are listening, which is obviously hopefully plenty. The way that network broadcasting happens in the States is that Comcast would have their national broadcasting ad slots that would still remain the same, and they would still only be available through upfront, through direct buys. So things like the kind of the major TV shows, like, I suppose, in the UK, like the premium Saturday night slots, like Saturday Night Takeaway or Michael McIntyre's The Big Show, whatever the hell that one's called. I do not know what that one's called. And then the rest of it is local broadcaster ad slots. And that represents about 2 minutes per hour of advertising content. So apparently these big network national spots would still be bought the same way. And it's these local kind of more, I suppose you could almost think of them as more like DRTV in this country, as we would buy DRTV, kind of like all the ads that target old people basically that sit at home all day and watch TV. That's DRTV as I understand it from my buying days. It's a bit of an unfair way of describing it, but it kind of largely what it meant. But so the slots that are available through this new linear tie-up, linear programmatic tie-up, would be those local 2 minutes per hour slots. But we're talking massive, still talking, it doesn't sound like very much, we're still talking massive reach. Like, Comcast is huge. So we're talking like, ESPN, Comedy Central, BET, Food Network, ESPN, MSNBC, Fox News. Like, there's still so many different channels across all the different verticals that exist within that. But that, I think, is the amount of inventory that would be available to programmatic buyers. This still opens up a lot, and still opens up a whole plethora of ad slots that wouldn't have been available to digital-only buyers before. And I think it then raises lots of questions around who's going to buy it, because even now, CTV and linear TV are still bought completely separately, often from completely different teams. It depends on the makeup of the agency. Assume we're talking about agency buyers. The makeup of the agency is very, very, you know, every holdco does it differently. Some of them it's all run by one central team. Some of them it's run by client department rather than channel department. And some of them, like CTV and linear TV, are completely separate. So when you blur the lines of linear TV versus programmatically bought linear TV, who's going to buy it? I'm sure there'll be arguments there. But I also then thought to myself, well, hang on, aren't we doing that already in this country? We're not. Like Sky AdSmart is kind of almost doing that with addressable TV. But where they are doing it is in Germany. And Germany has always been pretty advanced when it comes to TV anyway, certainly linear TV. So Virtual Minds are running this through Ad Alliance with RTL and ProSiebenSat.1. And that has been running a while. And it's also kind of like, there's also potentially work being done in Australia. They've been working on it for a few years, it looks like. So that will probably be available, again, sort of certain slots. I'm assuming there'd be more local slots rather than national slots. But again, Australia is a much different country to North America, and areas to North America, so I'm not quite sure how it will work. But it's interesting because it does help with, I suppose, fragmentation. And the way that ads are bought, as I understand it, in the US, it can be quite fragmented, sort of local versus national. And we really understood that when the whole Jimmy Kimmel thing kicked off, kind of the different local distributors that stopped airing his show. But nationally, it was I'm still finding it quite complicated. But it shows you kind of how complex the North American TV market is. We also have lots of fragmentation in Europe, lots of fragmentation in APAC. So it is something that could, I think, work and be interesting. It does open up new opportunities for digital-only buyers. But I did have to kind of go, what does this mean? I don't really understand it before I then came up with this, with these this plethora of thoughts.
Anything else to add to Lindsay's?
No.
No. Yeah. Very that, detailed.
Yeah, I think that covers an awful lot in a lot of depth and international background. So no, nothing I can really put on top of that.
But don't forget, it could all be wrong. So there is that.
But it sounded great. Oh, very well informed.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Even the German pronunciation of the networks was,
well, you know,
you'd expect.
Yes, you'd have to.
I would hope so. Yeah.
Do you think this is a broader transformation into how traditional TV then is going to be bought and sold?
Yes, I suppose. Yeah. It's a way of kind of, it's not competing. I don't think linear has to compete with CTV because, like Lindsay says, they're bought sometimes separately in the same agency. It is just a different way of consuming television. So anyway, to reach that wide audience that still does rely on linear on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you put it as the old people who sit and watch TV at home.
I'm sorry,
which
old
is,
people.
It's fair enough. And they, you know, they do. It's, you know, lots of advertisers, you know, focus on that demographic entirely. Yeah. You know, people's postcode lottery, it's, you know,
exactly.
Advertisers a lot across that. Donkey sanctuaries, I heard.
Yeah. Couldn't be. The Churchill chairs that rise up for people
exactly.
to clock out the chair.
Who?
I'd like one of those, actually, if it was... I wouldn't mind one.
Stannis Derlitt.
Christmas present.
Yeah. Stannis Derlitt, another one, exactly. Yeah. He is old people.
And but there is, you know, it is still, you know, old people have disposable income, and it's actually a really interesting demographic to get to. So, yeah, ad buying being made easier, being made programmatic, it's, if it allows that audience to be tapped, then great for the advertisers.
Yeah, what are the benefits for the advertisers?
I think that's ease of buying. I think it brings everything into one place. So from a planning perspective, it probably makes it easier. I think especially if you are a performance advertiser, you'll likely skew to investing more in digital bought channels than you would do traditional bought channels because they would seem to be bigger budget and more branding focused. So that would seem to be buying a 7 p.m. slot on Saturday Night TV or kind of a big out-of-home display, not digital. If you're a performance buyer that's digital focused, this does open up more inventory to you and saves you having to kind of go and buy DRTV separately, which is, I suppose, what, you know, again, old people TV, it's having to go buy those slots separately. So I think that probably makes it easier, and there probably are some economies of scale to doing that as well. It should hopefully make planning a bit easier as well, because there is kind of a sort of tug of war sometimes between traditional channels and digital channels of the same medium, so TV and app, TV being kind of a really good one. I wonder if it might make that slightly easier as well, because the lines are becoming less blurred, and it does then make it feel more performance versus brand, and like, this is my branding budget, this goes into these big slots, and performance budget can just go into this slot. Although, of course, you know, digital budgets, That assumes that digital can't build brands, which obviously is not true, but it does mean that if I were a brand thinking that way, that might be how I would then spit it out.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, let's see how this unfolds and see how quickly the buy side adapt. Let's move on to our third story for the week. A number of ad tech industry members have come together to launch the Ads Context Protocol, or ADCP, as it's been called, an open standard designed to support AI agents in planning, transacting, and optimizing advertising campaigns. ADCP defines the standardized interface from agent to platform and agent to agent communication, allowing buyers and sellers to connect their agentic systems. The shared infrastructure functions as a common language between different players within the ad ecosystem, bringing the entire marketplace together. John, how do you think this impacts different players in the ad tech ecosystem?
I think this has stirred up quite a lot of thought in the industry. And, you know, we ran an opinion piece on it this week where some of the industry's brightest gave us their thoughts on how it's going to work. It's come out to a lot of hype. It was announced, you know, it's launched as the next big thing, and the agentic is finally kind of setting out a protocol for the way agentic AI is going to communicate. And it's really, really interesting that, you know, that someone's jumped out, you know, Box jumping out to take a lead on this. And there's, you know, there's a good range of companies who have got involved to bring this to life. I don't know how it impacts people initially. I think as a set of standards, a suggested set of standards for agentic AI, it is interesting, and we know that agentic AI is coming, and you know, the bots communicating with each other and how this is going to set that out in terms of the ad buying process for agentic is fascinating. I don't know what impact it'll have immediately, but it's more the concept of it that interests me. I think in terms of, is it just, it's talk about ease of buying, it's talk about breaking down the boundaries, is this just programmatic back again, rehashed? It's the same promises, but now we've got new tech. Is it shiny new thing and we've gone early? I don't know. But it is interesting to see companies come together and try and get a handle on this and to try and take a lead, I think.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think I agree with where John's going on his thoughts on it. I think that, firstly, I feel like it's too soon. I feel like that we don't, as an industry, really have a handle on, first of all, are we saying agentic or agentic? This feels like the yogurt conversation we had in the office earlier, but
agentic for me.
Agentic. I keep hearing like different. Okay, good.
What's right and wrong?
Well, there you go. Exactly. What is language? Honestly, but yeah, I feel like it is. I don't think as an industry we've grappled AI yet. We don't know what. I feel like bringing out a set of standards will. And kind of and applying a technical layer to a set of standards will just make advertisers and publishers go, we don't know what does that mean? We don't know what we're doing yet. And it could actually freak them out a bit. And I think that we're so not there yet with AI. Obviously, we know it's going to move quickly. Agentic AI is going to move very, very quickly. And the adoption rate is going to be high. So it makes sense to bring out some standards. I question the rationale behind those sets of companies bringing out these standards for lots of reasons. One is it giving that group of people too much power? When should it be something that's handled more like by an IAB or something that somebody that's much more doesn't have the same skin in the game as like say you know Bock and Scope 3 and PubMatic and Magnite and the others that have got involved as well. Secondly, the way I'm understanding agentic AI and what it could do for the industry is that it could basically, I mean, the good thing about it is that it can bring sellers and buyers closer together. So that's bringing us back to kind of how things used to be when, as a buyer, I'd call up my publisher and go, can I buy this, you know, in The Guardian? And the Guardian would go, yeah, sure, here you go. And that's, you know, transaction done, nice and easy. Not particularly scalable, but nice and easy. This is bringing it back to taking out the middle man. But then our industry is built on middlemen. So if we're taking out the middleman, what does that mean for the very structure of the ad tech industry? And then why are those middlemen getting involved in building standards for it? Is it so they can control the narrative? Is it because they control whether agentic AI disintermediates these intermediaries, these middlemen that have kind of performed the framework of all the different layers of our industry? And so there's a lot of, I've got a lot of questions around that, and I've seen lots of opinions around that, and it's making me kind of like not particularly, I'm a bit sort of sitting on the fence about it. There are definitely some good things about it, but I wonder again, like, because of who's doing it and because of what the standards are. I think, you know, generally, I think people seem excited about it, but I do see people kind of going, yeah, it's good, it's got some good things. But I was reading, you know, I think Digiday article with Thomas Lutzen from Ekstrabladet in Denmark, who was saying it looks like it's got some exciting things, but I question how quickly it will scale. I question adoption. And I think the adoption question is the big thing, like who's going to sign up for it. So far, none of the big dogs have signed up for it. So Google, Trade Desk, Amazon DSP, they don't technically need to. But if they aren't involved, does that mean we're creating more fragmentation by having like this new agentic AI standards walled garden versus a Google walled garden, a Trade Desk walled garden, Amazon DSP walled garden? Like, what does that then ultimately look like? I think that makes it feel a bit more complicated than maybe it needs to be. Because a standard needs to be a standard. It needs to be standardized across almost everybody. And then maybe think about like other standards. So I've been looking into this as well. Like, if you think about other standards that kind of are really prevalent in our industry. So you've got ads.txt, you've got OpenRTB, you've got Prebid, like all of them, like ads.txt, really easy to implement. Like literally put a code on your domain, like bish bash bosh. Like it meant that the DSPs could filter the bad quality inventory and let the good stuff go through. Great for publishers, great for advertisers to know what they're buying, really easy to implement, high adoption very quickly. OpenRTB, arguably the framework of RTB and the framework of our industry. Again, high adoption. They brought out new versions of it. OpenRTB 3.0, remember that, anyone? That was a complete disaster because they basically brought out a framework that was completely different from the previous versions of it. And then everyone had to recode everything and everyone went, I'm not going to adopt that. I'm not, why would I do that? Like, this took so long in the first place. I'm not just redoing everything in the back end. So the adoption wasn't high, despite the concept was good, but the adoption wasn't high. And then you've got Prebid, instant revenue lift for publishers. So a no-brainer to kind of implement Prebid and do what needs to be done to kind of make header bidding more standardized. But then you had the Trade Desk get involved with Prebid. The Prebid was built by publishers for publishers. Trade Desk got involved and the agencies got involved. So kind of it became a sort of buy-side conversation. And then Prebid announced they were going to be changing their transaction ID from having standardized transaction IDs across bidders to a different one per bidder. Have I got the right way around? Probably not. Anyway, it was what they were doing, good for publishers, bad for buyers. And so Trade Desk were like, well, screw you. We're going to create our own version called Open Ads. And publishers, if you want our demand, you will have to go to Open Ads. Like, don't use Prebid, use Open Ads, because actually we, like, if you're using the Trade Desk, it doesn't make any sense for you to buy through, to sign up to Prebid. So you have to use us instead. So, and again, it creates more fragmentation. And I feel like a standard, unless it literally is a standard that can be applied to everybody and everyone understands it and everyone agrees with it, it can't really be a standard. And the other thing about agentic AI, which I think the industry hasn't grappled with yet, is it's a giant black box. So again, any standard has got to address that and address the transparency issue that we have been battling for as long as this industry began. This doesn't address that yet, I don't think, and it really, really needs to. And that, I think, is going to be, again, where there's going to be lots of concerns, certainly from the buy side, around transparency. And so, yeah, I've got lots of questions and no answers, but I think it's very interesting. And I think it does start something that's going to start a bit of a juggernaut, and it could even make the kind of the adoption of agentic AI quicker, like go quicker, because it's on people's radar now and they go, oh, I wasn't thinking about doing this for 5 years, but actually now there's a standard around it. Maybe I should be looking into this more. Like, and I do think there's going to be certain players in the industry that are going to be looking at this and panicking and thinking this is actually going to escalate things and expedite things. And actually we need to try and maybe get some more control over this. Hence why maybe the likes of the SSPs are involved in it, because they want that control. I don't know. But I've got so many thoughts running through my head.
From the cynical point of view, there's a lot in your last point. Shirley Marshall wrote about AdCP and the agentic stuff in a critical piece today. It's like really well thought out. But she described it as hype by committee, which I thought was a fascinating turn of phrase for it.
Yeah.
And I think that plays nicely into the gatekeeping argument. Like this, you know, the agentic AI cat jumped out the bag and all of a sudden it's like, oh, someone needs to control this quickly and, you know, get ahead of the game. And it's that, you know, it's like we are putting a set of standards here. It's like putting your flag in the sand and making people take note. And I like that idea of, first of all, like the gatekeeping of it, whether, you know, it is you know, it's going to take away so many layers that the only response is to quickly add another one. Like, oh no, quick, add another layer. We are still useful. Which interests me.
Yeah,
like,
and we need. I thought everyone was crying for fewer layers, not more layers.
But yeah.
But this also arguably is designed to get rid of those layers while also not getting rid of them. It sits on top of everything else, but then gets rid of everything in between. So
it's a meta layer.
Yeah, it's a meta layer. Yeah, I love a meta layer
on top of all of it. But yeah, you were right. It was too soon, and you know, people are struggling to understand what agentic AI is. And in the piece, the reaction piece we ran, Audrey Boisemo from Azerion, she described it as standing at a turning point where AI systems are no longer just executing but collaborating and talking together. And I think that's a neat way of putting how agentic is. That is what it is.
Yeah.
It is your AI talking to another AI. But within that, massive black box. It's like, my black box will now talk to your black box and it'll just tell us what the results are of their conversation.
Exactly.
It's like, it's funny when you step away from it and look at what we are creating and on the verge of being created. It's sort of all the transparency we've discussed in the industry over the last 5 or so years. It's sort of like, forget that. We've got something that can do it quicker and much bigger scale. So caution industry. But it is, interesting to see someone jump out the gate and put the flag in the stand. Is it laying down a gauntlet now for the IAB and IAB Tech Lab?
Or even is it laying down a gauntlet for Prebid? Yeah. I mean, should they be getting involved in creating a standard for this? Because it ties in very nicely with everything that Prebid represents in terms of kind of the transparency between buyer and seller. So actually, should someone like them be getting involved with it? I don't know, but I still feel like maybe the wrong companies. And maybe it's fine for them to build it and then go, I'm stepping away. This now becomes open source. Do what you want with it. That's okay. But if they still have too much skin in the game, I think that then will cause concerns and it could cause more fragmentation than its intention. And that's what I think is going to be potentially interesting.
Yeah. Is this like field of agentic dreams? If we build it, they will come.
Yeah, but I mean, that I think that's what they're... And of course, you know, Box involved with it because he likes to build things, break things, build things, break things, and not break things in a negative way. In like, I built this and now I'm like down the line going, was this the right thing? Let me have a play around and see if I can actually rebuild this better. And so that's very much what kind of what he is you know, arguably great at doing. But yeah, I just wonder if that's the right approach to how we as an industry handle agentic AI.
Yeah,
there's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot to dive into, see what the industry makes of it, what do they figure out about it, what agentic AI really is. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how this unfolds. But yeah, I'm going to call it there for this week. Thank you very much, John. As always, thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me.
And Lindsay, great to have you.
Likewise.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts, guys. And that's it for the MadTech podcast this week. Tune in next week.
You've been listening to the MadTech podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.